God damn you.
It is a little strange that we have such an aversion to slavery because historically there have been abuses for many people, poor people, perhaps people who weren't educated, perhaps people who had no other opportunity. Working for a gentle, caring, loving master was the best of all possible worlds.
Campus is a loaded minefield. There are girls everywhere. And it's guaranteed that I will pass some attractive girls as I walk in between classes.
If it's not requiring her to sin, but simply hurting her, then I think she endures verbal abuse for a season, and she endures perhaps being smacked one night, and then she seeks help from the church.
It would be hard for me to see how a woman could be a drill sergeant.
Right face, left face, keep your mouth shut, private.
Over men without violating their sense of manhood and her sense of womanhood.
Go home.
They want power, not equality. This is the highest location they can ascend to that power in the evangelical church.
We are meaning makers and storytellers. And the stories we tell ourselves are the stories that shape our lives.
We need each other badly or goodly. We need each other. And we keep forgetting again and again and again that we are loved. And we say, no, I'm no good. No, I messed it all up. No, I feel so guilty. No, I feel so ashamed. We need each other. In the midst of this difficult, dark, and often violent world, we need to have a community of support to which we can call all people and be a community of hope.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Opening. This is Rick Pidcock, and I have some big news to share with you today. I am actually recording this not in the middle of the night, but in the middle of the day. How is that possible with five kids? Well, we decided to make a bit of a change in our lives this year. A couple weeks ago, last week, we put two of our five kids in public school for the first time. So we have always homeschooled our kids, and it's been tough, especially with Ruth Ellen having cancer this last year, and with all of the things that I'm wanting to do with creating and writing. It's just a lot on my plate to have to do all that and have to take care of the house since I'm a stay-at-home dad and everything. So we decided to put two of our kids in school this year. We're going to put the others in next year. And so suddenly, I only have three kids at home. And it is amazing how big of a difference that is when you go from five kids down to three. It almost feels like, where did all the noise go? It's kind of stunning that it would be that big of a difference, but it is. So this will open up some more time for me for creating some things. And one of the things is today, for example, Ruth Ellen has off work, so she went and took the kids to the library. So I've got some time this afternoon to do some recording and decided to go ahead and take advantage of that and do a new episode of The Opening. So with that, I also have another announcement to make. I've been thinking about the work that I'm putting out, and I wanted to announce that I am offering an opportunity for readers and listeners to support my work. And before I do that, before I get into the details of all of that, I wanted to just share a bit about our financial situation. So, and the work that I'm doing, and how all of these changes are affecting this. So Ruth Ellen is an interior designer for Lazy Boy, and she makes a decent salary that pays for our needs. And so we're not in, you know, financial straits, desperate financial situation or anything like that. But I, with the things that I create, I make money from the articles that I write that get published by certain outlets, but it's really not a ton of money. You know, with everything that I'm putting out there, I don't really get paid for much of what I actually do. And with five kids during this time when costs of living are rising, life is getting a bit expensive. So any extra income I can get definitely helps. So in addition to the paid articles that I write, I've written and would like to write more articles for other places that can't afford to pay their writers. So, for example, I've written in an article for a website that runs a hotline for women who are victims of abuse. And unfortunately, I can only invest so much of my time in doing free articles like this, but I'd like to do more of them. And I'm also producing two podcasts, this one on religion and politics in the United States, and then another podcast, Infinite Mystery, which is on contemplative spirituality. And then I'm also recording and releasing music. So I've got 13 singles released, an album, I've got another EP coming soon. And in case you didn't know, the recording costs with professional musicians can really be expensive. And when it's in a music world where that's more streaming focused now, streaming pays out virtually nothing. So, you know, I've got a lot of expenses with that. And then also, you know, I'm doing a lot of social media posts that are like 300 to 450 word mini essays on religion, science, or politics during the day. And so while they don't take as much of an effort that an article or an album takes, they're pretty well thought out. And so I've also got books that I'm writing and that are going to be coming out over time. And in order to produce all of this content, I also have to have the time and money to be able to keep up on reading how the conversation about religion is in the United States is unfolding. I have expenses with purchasing books, with articles, with newspaper subscriptions or different things, and with all of my responsibilities with the kids as a stay-at-home dad, it's just kind of a lot. So I decided to start a Patreon page for anyone who would be interested in supporting the work I'm already doing. I'm not planning on ever putting my work behind a paywall, and I'd rather keep it all for free while maintaining what I do. And so with the amount of content that I'm already putting out, I don't have a ton of time to add very specific incentives for specific tiers for Patreon people. I'm basically saying I'm doing all this work, and if you're at all interested in supporting me in it, feel free to do so. And so you can look up Rick Pidcock on Patreon. I think it's like patreon.com/Rick Pidcock. You can get to my page. And basically, you know, you can support me for as little or as much as you want. And if just a couple people sign up, then I'll at least take it as a free coffee once a month while I'm working on stuff. So I really appreciate all of the reading and interacting and sharing that you guys do with my content and the feedback that you give me. So it's been a lot of fun, and I'm having a ton of fun, and I'm looking forward to all the things that we'll be able to create. So today we're going to be reading and reflecting through an article that I wrote on September 4th, 2020 for Baptist News Global, entitled My Journey Through Purity Culture and Christian Worship Music. The year was 1993. I was a sweaty junior high kid who had recently gotten my first stick of deodorant and had begun experiencing sensations in my body that felt both good and confusing. But one night, as my brothers and I were laying on our sleeping bags in the middle of the living room, our dad asked us, "Have I ever told you about the worst sin ever?" Sure enough, the sin turned out to be sex. Pure fear. I grew up in a disembodied fundamental Baptist Christianity that fed on fear. We were warned about the dangers of getting caught masturbating when the rapture happened, and it was certain to happen by Y2K. So we knew we weren't going to be able to get married. Because the Bible says that things that are done in secret will be shouted from the rooftops, we were convinced that God had piles of VCR tapes of us masturbating, that he would kick off the first 100,000 years of heaven at the Bema Seat publicly shaming us with. Fear of our sexuality was everything to us. Don't hold hands or it'll lead to having sex. Don't watch PG movies or it'll lead to watching R-rated movies of people having sex, and then you'll end up having sex. The girls at our Christian high school had to wear culottes over their windsuit pants for PE outside during the winter, or else we might end up having sex. One night, during a revival service, the evangelist was preaching about purity and pressured all the teenagers to come forward to sign a purity pledge and receive a virginity certificate. I had no plans of having sex before marriage. Still, something about that evening just made me feel so used and dirty. But I knew that not to sign the pledge would cause total panic at home. So with a bowling ball of shame in my stomach, I walked forward to get my virginity certificate. I turned around to see the face of a friend looking down at her lap. My heart ached as I pictured her being thrown into hell for having sex. Of course, she's happily married with kids now. Pure politics. In her book Pure, Linda Clay Klein explores the historical and political origins of this purity culture of the 1990s that she grew up in as well. She explains how the sexual revolution followed by the AIDS crisis led to many Americans giving in to fear. Every president from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush invested heavily in abstinence only until marriage education. The federal government has spent more than $2 billion on abstinence only programs since 1981. Klein explains, much of this funding came through the Title V abstinence only until marriage program, which is still in place today. This program requires states to match every four federal dollars that they receive with three state-raised dollars, presumably increasing the state-level contributions made towards abstinence-only programs in the process as well. The money is then redistributed to community-based organizations, faith-based schools, local and/or health state health departments, and schools. This multi-billion dollar investment by our government allowed conservative Christians to flood the marketplace with purity paraphernalia such as jewelry, books, Bibles, or any other product you could imagine. The Silver Ring Thing claims to have hosted around 1,300 events, while convincing more than 684,000 young people to sign purity pledges. Another ministry claims to have reached more than 4 million teenagers. Klein says, if that many young people have been reached by just this one curriculum, we can only begin to imagine how many have been reached by the vast array of other products. While there were a number of ministries that profited from federal money, the Southern Baptist Convention launched True Love Waits in 1993 and catapulted to become the most successful player in the industry. Klein explains, True Love Waits actively campaigned the government to allocate money to abstinence only until marriage programming, and a year after its launch, startled the country by bringing 20,000 adolescents to the National Mall, where they staked 211,156 signed purity pledges on the lawn. Afterward, 150 purity activists had a special session with President Bill Clinton. 2 years later, Congress allocated $50 million a year for the aforementioned Title V abstinence only programming. Pure patriarchy. By the time I graduated from high school in 2000, I had just spent the previous decade in constant sheer terror. I was going to pursue a BA in Bible from Bob Jones University, the bastion of fundamentalist Christianity, where I desperately needed to find a girl to marry before the rapture happened. The only problem was that I also read a book by a 21-year-old named Joshua Harris. The name of the book? I Kiss Dating Goodbye. I had to find someone to marry before the rapture, but I couldn't date. I Kiss Dating Goodbye went on to sell over 1 million copies, and Joshua, who was one of my generation, became the face of the entire movement. As we've come to learn since then, many lives were deeply wounded by his writing, and he has since recanted his entire theology and apologized. While the things Joshua wrote were very abusive and immeasurably harmful, my bigger concern is with the person who groomed him, the conservative evangelical leader C.J. Mahaney. In a 2011 sermon, Mahaney shared two letters from young men that totally encapsulate purity culture's view of women. He read, "Each and every day is on campus is a battle. I'm thankful God has created me to be attracted to women. However, campus is a loaded minefield. There are girls everywhere. And it's guaranteed that I will pass some attractive girls as I walk in between classes. I either have to be actively engaging my mind and my spirit to be praying, quoting scripture, listening to worship music, or simply looking at the sidewalk to make it through unscathed. Many days, it takes all four to be safe. The thing that women do not seem to fully grasp is that the temptation toward lust does not stop for us as men. It is continual. It is aggressive. It does all it can to lead men down to death. To the girls who are ignorant, please serve your brother and have your dad screen your wardrobe. Ask him how you can better choose holiness over worldliness. He's a guy, and he knows more than you do on the issue. In the video, Mahaney identifies women with such terms as battles, wars, loaded minefields, ignorant, dangerous, scathing, unsafe, threatening of death, choosing seduction, bait, needing to be avoided at all costs, a continual barrage, careless, distractions, disappointing, and a whole myriad of other derogatory, shame-fueling labels. Mahaney's solution is clear. Women are supposed to ask their dads to screen their wardrobe. Men are supposed to ignore and fight the women at all costs by praying, quoting scripture, listening to worship music, or simply looking at the sidewalk. And in both cases, they are to look at penal substitutionary atonement, where God was eternally angry at them, but decided to get his anger out on Jesus at the cross instead. Then Mahaney celebrates, "This is the gospel!" But even then, even with God having gotten his anger out on Jesus, there apparently is still a danger of the guys dying in the battle. For some Arminian theology, this would happen by masturbating too much and losing your salvation. For Mahaney's Calvinism, it would happen by masturbating too much and revealing that you were never saved to begin with. Pure passion. With all of these pent-up hormones and denial of desires, there had to be a release somewhere. For my generation, worship music became the perfect outlet. We've all heard the stereotypical Jesus is my girlfriend worship songs that are so easy to mock. Some of the lyrics I've read have sexual repression written all over them. Former worship leader Michael Gunger joked about sexually repressed worship to comedian Pete Holmes on Pete's You've Made It Weird podcast, saying, "We had started this church. I was the worship leader. It was the hot thing in Tulsa. In 3 years, it already had a few thousand people coming to it, and it was like all the hot college girls writhing in the front. It was the scene." Linda K. Klein shares about a study in 1912 by Emil Durkheim, where Durkheim identified collective effervescence as the emotional high we experience during religious group settings. She writes of the philosopher Rudolf Otto, who in 1923 spoke of religion's heat, vitality, passion, energy, all coming together to create a consuming fire. Imagine if he had seen today's worship environments with the lighting, fog machines, dancing, rock music, and attractive young worship leaders singing about being intimate with Jesus. She concludes, "I have never seen collective effervescence as intense as when a bunch of evangelical adolescents fired up on hormones get together. Here the adolescents' most extreme emotions are called forth time and time again." With the teenagers of the 1990s leaving home and going off to college, the worship culture was about to change dramatically. In a January 2001 music column for Campus Life, a CCM music industry insider said, "We're always getting new CDs here. We get all types, pop, rock, alternative, hip-hop, hardcore, gospel." About the middle of last year, 2000, we started noticing a trend. Seemed like every other CD that arrived here came with this label or something like it, praise and worship music. Whatever they called it, we started getting tons of it. We started hearing it on Christian radio more and more, and we started singing the same songs in our churches and youth groups. In her book, Singing the Congregation, Baylor University's Monique Ingalls explores how CCM record labels capitalized on the sudden explosion of modern worship music beginning in the year 2000. They began pushing their artists to release worship albums and shaped the worship discourse to be one of creating an experience of feeling. Pure healing. While I'm sure there are many factors that fed into the suddenly explosive growth and reshaping of modern worship in the 2000s, I can't help but wonder how much of my generation's disembodiment, fueled by the purity culture of the 1990s, led to the sexually repressed worship culture of the 2000s, as soon as we graduated from high school and left home for college. On a recent episode of the Liturgists podcast, Hillary McBride said, "When I think about singing and worship music, I think about the fact that vibration in our voice box activates the larynx branch of our vagus nerve, which signals that it's okay for trauma to move through our body. Humming is a self-care practice because it signals to your nervous system, it's okay. You can move through it. You can talk about it. You're safe. You can connect. You can ask for help. We are bearing their abuse in our beautiful bodies. We are wearing our wounds in our worship. What if our worship has become our purity culture trauma moving through our bodies? What if the things we dislike about modern worship music are actually a subconscious cry for help? What we need is not a theological reformation of worship lyrics, but a healing of our minds, hearts, and bodies from the shame of purity culture. When we discover and embrace the beauty of ourselves, we'll converge in love for our neighbors. And together, we could reshape worship gatherings into a new consciousness and freedom beyond anything we've experienced." It's interesting looking back at this article because I think one sentence that kind of embodies a lot of where my writing has gone has been in that last paragraph where I said, "What we need is not a theological reformation of worship lyrics, but a healing of our minds, hearts, and bodies from the shame of purity culture." And In one sense, I would agree with that now, but in another sense, I would kind of maybe emphasize it a little bit differently. So a lot of people talk about worship lyrics. It's easy to make fun of, you know, the worship song that's got the "Jesus is my girlfriend" language, or that has the repetitive, "I could sing of your love forever, I could sing of your love forever, I could sing of your love forever, I could sing of your love forever," you know, like, There's everybody mocks those. And then some people will make fun of the theologically very thick, lyrically complex songs that, you know, where they're like every song covers all of evangelical Christian theology for, you know, from front to finish. It's all a systematic thing, and every statement in it is, like, you know, very detailed and structured. And so a lot of people, you know, they debate about where the lyrics need to go. Do we need more emotional lyrics? Do we need more doctrinally rich lyrics? And I don't think that that is where the focus needs to be, is on reforming those lyrics. I agree with that. I think that the focus does need to be on healing our minds, hearts, and bodies from shame. But here's what I would say is that when you heal in your mind and your heart and your body, the lyrics of the songs that you sing are going to change. The lyrics of the liturgies that you use in your church and the prayers are going to change. Because so much of the lyrics are shame lyrics. So much of them are about hierarchy, of honoring up the hierarchy and identifying yourself as low, as a slave, as negative sounding language. It's identity forming, that, and you bear that trauma in your body. And so it's really interesting as we see the power of music and technology in a corporate worship gathering that's really helping our bodies to engage and to move through the subconscious trauma that we feel, and yet the lyrics are undermining all of that and actually reinforcing the trauma that we feel. And so it's a bit of a mess, and it's a lot to work through, but I think that we need to be looking for ways to heal the embodied trauma that we all feel. And one way that I'm been that I've personally been doing that recently has been through yoga. I signed up for yoga a few months ago and have been going every week. And it's been an amazing experience of growing in embodiment and presence and mindfulness. And for me, it hasn't been about stretching, but it's been about a, it's been a spiritual experience for me. And a few weeks ago, our teacher was talking about worthiness. And she said that we are worthy of love for who we are and that we don't have to prove ourselves. And having lived my life in evangelicalism, those were theological statements to me. So after class, I wanted to talk with her about it. And I told her, I said, when I was an evangelical, I believed that there was only one who was worthy, and it wasn't me. It was Jesus. And the only reason I was allowed to be in God's presence was because Jesus obeyed perfectly and then took the punishment that I deserved on the cross. And the only thing I was that I was worthy of was to be burned in hell forever. But when I said those words to her, I noticed how my throat closed up. So, whether evangelical theology is true or not, it has affected me so deeply that my body involuntarily closed up when I simply tried to say the words that I once sang about. Like, after all the healing work I've been through over the past 5 years, I still physically closed up, and there was nothing I could do about it. So, think about how I feel when people try to get me to believe in evangelical theology again. Like, first, you'd have to change the way I view about the Bible. Then you'd have to convince me that the Bible promoted evangelical theology, which I don't think it does. Then you'd have to show me how evangelical theology was good news. And good news that's good enough to celebrate despite what it would mean for the eternal souls of my family and friends. And in helping me want to celebrate it again, you'd have to deal with the embodied trauma that involuntarily rises in me when I simply talk about evangelical theology to my yoga teacher. Each of these things are virtual impossibilities in and of themselves. But if you combine them all together, it's simply not happening. I'm not going to go back to evangelical theology. Even though I write about religion professionally, I still feel trauma in my body when I read about it. So for evangelicals to confront me with their theology feels to me like they're traumatizing my body again. The disconnect between me and evangelicalism is far more than an intellectual one. It runs far deeper than a desire to be cool or to sin. Theological trauma is in my muscles and my bones. We have to be honest about this. And another area of embodied disconnect that I've been learning about and exploring has been embodied racial trauma. And it's not about blaming white people today for what white people did 100 years ago. When people bring up slavery or world, you know, the segregation or whatever people bring up, CRT. It's not about simply about blaming white people today for what white people did 100 years ago. It's about healing trauma that gets passed down through the generations in bodies of both the oppressors and the oppressed. I've been reading about how we soothe our own trauma by passing it on to others. There's a book called My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies. And Menachem, who wrote the book, is a trauma therapist. And they say trauma can also be inherited genetically. Recent work in genetics has revealed that trauma can change the expression of the DNA in our cells. And these changes can be passed from parent to child. These experiences appear to be held, passed on, and inherited in the body, not just in the thinking brain. And it's interesting that so much of evangelical solutions is, supposed solutions, are in the thinking brain. Just believe this theology. Of course, yes, you need to believe it with your heart, but and mean it in their mindset. But it is an intellectual framing that they try to solve it with. And so Menachem says that we soothe our own trauma by passing it on to others. That white people experienced and passed down trauma for centuries through torture, imprisonment, and public burnings for executions. And then we passed it on to black people through slavery and then institutionalizing our own trauma. So as a result, black people today have trauma in their bodies that have been passed down for generations. And so when they bring up injustices of the past and the present, they're speaking out of their embodied trauma and they're trying to heal. But white conservatives today get upset whenever these issues come up. They say, oh, black people are just trying to blame us for things our ancestors did like 100 years ago. But it's about healing trauma that gets passed down through the generations in bodies of both the oppressors and the oppressed. So for white people to ban the study of CRT and to deflect all talk of racial trauma is to ignore their own trauma as well. We hold in our bodies centuries of trauma from torture, executions, slavery, and wars. And I would add to this theology of eternal conscious torment that we're threatened with at young ages or any age. Who can imagine that? The ultimate fear placed on your body of the ultimate embodied pain and disconnection from everyone else and from God. And even if you get to go to heaven, you're disconnected from your body and from everyone else because you have to celebrate either while they're burning forever or because they're burning in hell forever because of what that points to with supposed grace for you. So all of us get disembodied. All of us feel that trauma in our bodies. And to open up toward healing, it's time that we begin naming and healing that trauma, not by banning discussion of it or pretending that it's about blaming us for things we never did, but by actually facing it and dealing with it. So speaking of healing from intergenerational trauma, you may have noticed that if you've read my bio anywhere, that I am a stay-at-home dad for 5 kids. So how am I working toward healing our intergenerational wounds for my kids' generation? That's what we'll be exploring in the next episode of The Opening.
I don't think that the church has integrity to speak any good news at all until the church actually understands the reality that it is living and has crafted bad news in public policy. It has established theological foundations for oppression that have lived throughout the times and only changed shape over the generations, but has not been repented of.
Bad theology always produces diminished psychology produces dysfunctional sociology. Dysfunctional sociology always produces oppressive anthropology, and then they always produce oppressive economics and ideologies. You see, it all flows from bad theology. Your notion of God is wrong or flawed. Your notion of self and others and power is wrong.
Thank you for listening to The Opening Podcast with Rick Pidcock. The Opening is a podcast that deconstructs the power dynamics of religious hierarchies and opens us up to healthy relationship. For more information about today's episode, please check out rickpidcock.com and follow on social media at rickpidcock.